Hello, Poisonees. You are listening to another special release from the Poisoner's Cabinet Patreon files. We've decided to give you another little taste of what we get up to over on our Patreon channel while we're on our December break. As ever, the format of Patreon is a little different to our main episodes, but we cover a wide range of subject matter on this subscriber-only channel. So if you like what you hear today, do head over to Patreon. You can sign up to listen to more than 70 extra episodes and bonus material for just $5 a month. Patreon is completely flexible, but we hope you'll think it's worth it. The link to Patreon is in the bio of all of our social media channels, or just search Patreon/The Poisoner's Cabinet. The episode you're about to listen to was recorded on the 17th of August 2021, and is a very special compendium of daring dastardly tales for your listening pleasure. Enjoy! Hello, Poison Patreons. Welcome to another episode of Deadly Nightcaps with me, Sinead.
And me, Nick.
Bringing you more tales of poisoning and murder cases, old and new, all washed down with drinks that make your dramas obsolete. Thank you to all of our delicious, lovely new Patreon subscribers. We hope you're having a lovely week.
Yes, what a jolly, delightful week it is.
Is it?
Well, I know it's quite sunny out there.
It is. Well, it's a novelty today because we're actually recording this Patreon episode in the morning.
11:30 in the morning.
It is. It is a sunny day. We've had coffee. We've strolled the streets of Canterbury.
Managing to resist a cocktail at 11:30 a.m.
There's a tiny bit of me that was like, it's not unacceptable to have a gin.
But I don't do Patreon things without a Negroni.
You really don't, no. But I feel like that is a slippery, sliding slope.
It is a slight step too far, I feel, so I've managed to resist the urge.
That is where alcoholism starts with. Yes. I think it's all right to have a drink at 11.
With 11:30 a.m. Negronis, yeah.
With a Negroni at 11:30, yeah. A gin and tonic, perfectly acceptable.
Oh, really? Okay.
Or a modest selection of breakfast wines.
Absolutely.
How are you, Nick?
I'm all right.
Is it going to be a show tune week?
Show tune week, yep.
Ethel Merman.
Absolutely. I'm going to sing the whole thing.
Yay. Anyone or anything you would like to poison this week?
I don't think so. My shoulder's a bit better.
Oh, is it? Good.
From last week, yeah. I can move it. See, swirly, swirly.
And so many Patreons have returned. I've also got a sore shoulder.
Something in the air. Shoulder demons going on.
I was going to say maybe new symptom of COVID, but shoulder demons.
No, shoulder demons.
Shoulder demons. Oh, no, because the devil's sitting on your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But does the devil sit on the right shoulder or the left shoulder?
I don't know. It depends if it's a good one or the bad one.
The bad one. No, a devil. It's a bad devil. It's an angel and a devil.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure which way around they go.
There is something in ye olde literature about the left and the right, one side being good, one side being evil. And I think the left is the evil one. I think.
Well, because left-handed people are, yeah, exactly, the work of the devil. So
they are the work of the devil.
So, yeah.
So, okay, we've established there's a little devil sitting on your shoulder.
Oh, no, because it was my right shoulder that was a problem. So now I had an angel.
Your angel was wearing you down.
He's fucked off, so.
He was whispering good things in your ear, like, be a good person, do more exercise.
See,
like,
that's
off!
Why no one's been poisoned. It's done the trick.
I'm going to poison mosquitoes because this year, maybe because they have been deprived of humans for the last year, because we've all been inside, I don't know why, they are attacking everyone I know and me. I'm now strawberry-flavoured to them.
I'm fine. I've been bothered by.
Eaten alive, I tell you.
Well, this is at the moment because my blood is mostly Negroni at the moment, so.
The mosquitoes drink from you and then fall dead out of the air.
Yeah, exactly. So they know to steer clear.
Well, should we talk about poison and murder for a bit?
I think it's probably wise that we do. Shall I tell you a story?
Yes.
Okay.
So. Oh, I know what we didn't ask.
What?
What are you drinking, Nick?
I have a very exciting blackcurrant squash.
I, too, have a blackcurrant squash because I'm in your house.
Yes.
It's blackcurrant and apple.
All blackcurrant and apple. Luxury.
A little apple-y goodness.
Yeah, we had a coffee, a very nice coffee.
Yeah.
Now we're on to a squash.
Until
crazy behaviour. Hand
gets to 12 and then we can drink again.
And then it's like, Negronis! Right, so today on Deadly Nightcaps, I am branching out into something a bit different.
This has not been cleared by the committee. Not been approved.
But,
okay.
Well, as you will know, it is not always easy to find a good story to write about that will fill one of our episodes.
This is true.
We do a lot of rambling that fills episodes as well, but we try to keep it mainly story-based.
I think the listeners have cottoned on to our trick there, really, yes. 15 minutes of story, 45 minutes of just noise.
But often when you're researching, you'll come across loads and loads and loads of cases that are brilliant and bizarre and weird, but they're just a bit too brief.
Tiny.
So today, we are going to have a compendium.
Oh, a compendium!
Yes, a compendium of short stories for your entertainment.
Ooh, a compilation.
A compilation episode.
An anthology episode.
Yes, indeed.
More words. Oh, exciting.
Where's
Yay.
My thesaurus? I don't know. So, for our first case of the day, we are starting in London.
I'm sorry, this now feels like... Do you remember The Storyteller, the series?
No.
Yes, you do. Probably. Jim Henson produced with John
yes.
Hurt.
Yes,
I think
yes,
it was called
yes.
The Storyteller.
Yes, a big wing chair on a Sunday evening.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want a big wing chair. Why is it Sunday evening?
When I think compendium of stories, because I think he only told one a week, but then sometimes there are a couple, and I'm like, ooh, good, it's story time.
I need a big book.
Need a big book and a dog that talks. No.
Right, so none of that.
None of that.
So we are starting in London.
Okay.
With the ever so respectable Reverend Elias Hulin. Yes, now Reverend Hulin is a French Protestant clergyman. He had been, in his younger days, a minister at the French Conformist Church in Soho. But when we meet him in 1870, he is 84 years old, retired, and living a very, very comfortable life.
Ooh.
Now, the Reverend was a very clever and resourceful man, and during his life, he had built up an impressive portfolio of property. He had houses in the most fashionable streets of London. He lived at number 15 Poulton Square in Chelsea.
Chelsea.
I looked it up. 15 Poulton Square still exists, and when it was last on the market, it sold for just under £6 million.
That's pretty cheap, actually, for London.
So, a decent house. A
yes.
decent-sized house. But he also owns number 24 and 32 Poulton Square.
Oh, okay.
As well as two houses nearby Wellington Square.
Bloody hell.
So, yes, quite the portfolio he has.
What's he keeping in these houses?
Well, tenants, mainly. Most of these properties are rented out, which gives him a considerable income. But he is often seen strolling through the Chelsea streets with his little dog.
There is a dog!
There's a little dog involved. He has a little dog.
Yeah. The little dog has a little dog?
No, the little dog has an even smaller dog.
And the smallest one is the one that talks, but no one can hear it.
Because he's so tiny. But as I say, he is often seen strolling along, calling in on his tenants to collect the rent and wish them a good day. His coin purse full of golden guineas jingling as he walks along the street.
You love this.
I love this. In May of 1870, the Reverend decides that one of his properties in Wellington Square needs a bit of work. So he hires some workers to do a bit of plastering and a bit of papering to get it ready for his next tenants. Every day, the Reverend would call into the house to see how things were going, and every day he would take out his purse of coins and hand each man their daily wage. After one of these visits, the Reverend spoke to one of the builders, a Scottish chap called Walter Miller. The Reverend tells Walter that he's going away for a few days to visit a friend up in Lincolnshire, and he entrusts Walter with the wages for the men for the time he would be away.
Ooh.
Days passed and the money that had been left for the wage bill runs out, but still no sign of the Reverend. It's not like him to forget his commitment. However, not long after, a young man arrives at the Reverend's home. He introduces himself as Monsieur Hulin, the Reverend's nephew. Freshly arrived in London from France, he said his uncle had written to him, saying that he was extending his stay in Lincolnshire for a while longer. He had sent him the key and told him to make himself at home.
Never trust a nephew who turns up on your doorstep. They're always a nephew or a niece. Never a child, never a sister, never a parent. It's always a nephew or a niece. And lies. Lies, every one of them.
So the young Monsieur Hulin is a very strange sight in the quiet streets of Chelsea. He's described as a foppish, foreign-looking individual.
Oh, wow. By who?
By the people in the area.
A foppish, foreign-looking
individual. He has a pince-nez. You know the little the spectacles that pinch over the nose? They're called pince-nez.
Oh, is that what they're called?
Yes, pince-nez.
Ooh.
And a very highly waxed moustache.
Ooh.
His accent is incredibly strong, with something a bit peculiar about it that they can't quite put their fingers on. But then none of the neighbours had ever met a Frenchman before, so perhaps they were all like this. They just weren't sure. But he was quite the spectacle.
They were just sort of looking at the moustache and the spectacles and went, we've never seen a Frenchman. He's missing the onions.
Yes. Where are his baguettes, they
said. Where are the bicycles that he rides daily?
Monsieur Hulin explained that his uncle had requested that his housekeeper, Mrs. Anne Boss, travel up to Lincolnshire to meet the Reverend. Reverend intended to stay a while, and Mrs. Boss knew exactly how he liked things done, so he wanted her there with him. Mrs. Boss tries to protest. How could the young master get on without a housekeeper? He didn't know the house, he doesn't know the city, hardly anyone could understand him. He insists that it was his uncle's wish and he would be just fine.
So she's spending a long time with this conversation because no one can understand it. What?
And so Monsieur Hulin takes over his uncle's affairs in London. He hires himself a new housekeeper.
Oh.
Who in one book is described as a sluttish looking woman.
Wow.
that's fairly damning.
Clearly you mean untidy and unkempt, or just as she rocks up in a bikini.
Yes.
The first bikini that's ever been seen. She's there. Brushing your drink, governor.
Much like that.
Oh, she's a sexy French maid.
A sexy French maid, yeah, absolutely. So he goes around, he collects his uncle's rents, he eats his food, he drinks his wine, and has a very jolly time with the housekeeper. One evening, a Monsieur Hulin sends for a removal man, and a Mr. Henry Piper duly arrives. He explains that his uncle is due back from his travels shortly, so he needs to move out, and that he has found a lovely little place in Fulham,
okay,
and that he's moving to. He doesn't have many belongings, but there is a wooden trunk in the kitchen that needs moving, so would he please oblige and shift it over to Fulham. Piper calls in his assistant to help lift the trunk, but as soon as it's off the ground, the men saw blood seeping from between the wooden planks.
What?
Piper drops the box down, alarmed, and asks what the hell is in the box. Monsieur Hulin does not answer the question, but shouts at the men to just tie the box up and get on with it, get on with the job, in his thick French accent. The removal men hardly understand a word, and Henry Piper refuses and sends his assistant out of the house to fetch the police. This is not right. Something good. Very wrong is going on here. Piper can see Monsieur Hulin get more and more angry and agitated until suddenly he yells, "Get that bloody box out," in a broad Scottish accent.
No!
As soon as he realises his mistake, he runs and he bolts out of the house with Piper giving chase.
Yes!
They run through the quiet streets of Chelsea for half a mile, with the police trying to catch up, until Monsieur Hulin slips and falls, allowing the police and Henry Piper to get him. Piper returns to the house with a Sergeant Large.
Sergeant Large, who
prizes open the bleeding trunk, and inside they find the doubled up body of housekeeper Anne Boss, with a thin rope wrapped around her neck.
Oh, wow. So the original housekeeper?
The original housekeeper.
So she didn't go to...
She didn't go up to Lincolnshire. She didn't go anywhere.
Oh my God.
She went to a trunk in the basement, in the kitchen. Under the cunning disguise, the foppish Frenchman, Monsieur Hulin, turns out to be Scottish plasterer Walter Miller.
Oh my goodness.
Who has created this elaborate persona to live a life of comfort at the Reverend's expense.
That's ballsy.
That's ballsy.
Surely people have seen him around if he's a plasterer and a labourer.
But not in his French outfit.
No.
And not, with his pince-nez and his elaborately waxed moustache.
And he's just developed the worst accent in the world.
And his strong Scottish accent with a twang of French.
So how
about
did you do that? So if you're a Scottish accent like that, and then I'm French and Hutzman.
So no wonder no one understands a word he's saying.
We need to get Dave Keane to do a French accent, but badly, and then record it for this episode.
When the police speak to Miller's builder colleagues at Wellington Square, they remembered that before he had quit the job, he had ordered a large hole to be dug in the garden.
Oh, God.
And sure enough, it was found to contain the body of Elias Hulin. The old reverend had been bashed over the head with a shovel and then strangled and thrown into the pit. The hole even contained an empty bottle of brandy, leading to police to assume that Walter had required a bit of Dutch courage before carrying out his crime.
Ugh.
Now, this double murder sends shockwaves throughout the upper-class neighbourhood. Such things don't happen here. All this murdering is supposed to happen in the undesirable places. The East End, the Whitechapels, that's where this sort of thing happens. Not in lovely, lovely Chelsea.
Whitechapel, fine.
Absolutely
fine. Chelsea.
Society is appalled about how a lowly manual labourer could plan the deliberate death of two blameless, respectable people, steal all their money and valuables, and almost get away with it.
Yeah, he's a clever man.
This is
a ballsy plot.
Absolutely. Walter Miller is sentenced to death at the Old Bailey and executed at Newgate on August the 1st. He is so violent towards his jailers that they have to strap him into a chair to hang him.
He keeps on trying
to run and get away from his jailers, so they strap him into a chair to hang him. But the executioner hadn't taken this into consideration, and Miller ended up dangling from the rope, slowly strangling to death.
Yeah, because the weight ratio, isn't it? Ooh. Well,
so the double Chelsea murder with a foppish French gentleman who turns out to be a Scottish builder.
Good story! Oh, yes, definitely we needed to hear that story, short as it is.
Ah.
Oh my, but that was a roller coaster. I know,
there's so much going on.
They had everything in 15 minutes. That was incredible. Ooh, yeah, I can't believe
But how
that
he got
happened.
Away with it. He got
did,
away with
he
it
got
for,
away
for
with
days
it.
And days and days and days, in weeks, in fact.
I mean, you couldn't make it up. This is the stuff that novels and films are made of. Like, oh my God, I love the confidence of that Scotsman. Absolutely. Going, I'm pretty sure I know what Frenchmen look like and sound like. And everyone's going, what the hell is he saying? Walking around with his moustache. And then he'd gotten a sexy housekeeper in,
absolutely.
Drinking the wine.
Yeah, he had taken the Reverend's purse full of coins. He was merrily going around collecting the rents, getting himself a bit of an income as well.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that because he's a labourer, he would have been seen around, recognisable, but clearly he did a good job.
His disguise was well done.
A foppish gentleman. God, I can only imagine what he was doing in the street. La, 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 la.
But how you go from a Scottish labourer to a foppish Frenchman, that's quite a leap in characterisation. But well done him.
Well done him. He's the greatest actor of his generation.
Greatest actor of his generation.
Unfortunately, also mad. And a murderer. Ooh, gruesome. Good story. Yay! I'm ready for another.
So for tale number two.
Tale number two.
We are heading to the other side of London, to the dark and scary streets of Whitechapel.
Yay! If you've just elbowed Jack the Ripper in here.
Meet Jack the Ripper. No, 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 no.
And his cafe. who is disguised as a Spaniard.
To meet the most respectable and successful businessman, Henry Wainwright.
Ooh, nice.
Henry owns a brush factory.
I don't know why that's funny.
People need brushes.
I know.
This is a time before Hoovers and Roombas and things like that. You need a brush. Multiple
why
brushes.
Why are brushes funny? I don't know why that's funny. Okay, carry on.
He has a factory at 84 Whitechapel Road and another further down the street at 215.
That's where the dustpan pans. Absolutely.
So, I don't know, one factory making bristles, the other one making handles or something, I don't know. But he lives a very comfortable life. He has a wife and four children, and they are all well known in the area, respectable, middle class business people. But he also has a bit of a reputation as a ladies' man. And is a regular at the local theatre and variety hall. Where he is often seen attempting to seduce the young actresses.
While they're on stage.
As they come off stage, he goes, oh, your performance was marvellous, darling, he says.
Yes. Look at this.
look at my brush. And he is quite successful with his seductions.
Well, it's a lot of money in brushes.
Well, indeed. He has one of his mistresses. Is 19-year-old Harriet Lane. They had met in 1871, and Henry had set her up in her own lodgings and given her an allowance of £5 a week.
Ooh.
During their time as man and mistress, Harriet gave birth to two children, and Henry provided an allowance for their needs too. Now, what started out as great fun for Harriet, after a few years, turned fairly miserable. At the beginning, she was young and free. Her lover took her to nice places and provided her with a home and an allowance which she could spend on nice, shiny things. But now she can hardly go out. She's got two young children to look after. And Henry does not seem to visit as often as he once did. Harriet hears from friends that Henry is still a regular at the theatres and clubs. He is still out there sweet-talking the young ladies, showing off his brush collection. And Harriet is getting more and more annoyed about her lover's increasing indifference towards her.
Well, she's not shiny and fun and new anymore.
Exactly.
And he's not available to have a nice married life with her.
Indeed. Now, this only gets 10 times worse when she discovers that Henry is keeping another permanent mistress, a younger ballet dancer named Alice Day. Now, Henry is juggling a wife and two mistresses and countless lovers. But the brush business is not going quite as well. Henry had inherited the factory from his father. And it turns out that Henry is not quite the businessman he thought he was, and the business is hemorrhaging cash. Keeping two mistresses on the go couldn't have been particularly cheap either. Henry has to sell the family home and move to a much humbler house in a much rougher area, which does not please his wife whatsoever. You would have thought that perhaps cutting down on your number of mistresses would have been the first sort of cost-saving option, but no.
I think if you've got that many mistresses, you don't then start to think, if I just cut down on these, then you're not the sort of person who likes to economise.
This is very true.
Or is one who is frugal in their taste.
Absolutely. Horse will have her trinkets.
And he will have his horse.
Indeed. By 1874, Henry realises that he has to do something about Harriet. Not only is she an expense that he really cannot afford, he much prefers visiting the younger and prettier Alice Day. Whenever he does visit Harriet, she is often drunk. She screams at him for seeing other women and not being there. No, she would have to go. We'd have to go, cannot carry on like this.
She's every right to be angry.
One day in September, Henry invites Harriet to visit him at the factory at 215 Whitechapel. She arrives expecting some sort of apology, a declaration of love. He's going to leave his wife. He's going to run off with her. Mm. They will all live happily ever after. Instead, Henry pulls out a pistol and shoots her in the head.
Oh, God. Well, that was blunt.
Yes, indeed.
I thought he'd do some sort of elaborate ruse where he pushed her into the bristle vat.
No, no,
and
no.
And then she was slowly poked to death.
That would be a dramatic ending. But he's gone, no, none of that. Here's my gun. I'm going to shoot you.
I'm going to shoot you
in the head.
Oh, no.
He then takes out a knife. And just to be sure, slits her throat. He buries her body in a shallow grave under the floor in a small workshop at the back of the factory. Not many people miss Harriet Lane. She was often drunk and a nuisance and loud and noisy. And it's quite nice to have a bit of peace and quiet, really. When anyone did ask Henry what happened to her, he would tell them, oh, she has gone off with another man. They've gone to Europe. And she's having a delightfully jolly time. That was that. And Henry believes he's got rid of one complication. This is done and dusted. Oh, I'm got away with this scot-free. But things did not quite work out. Just a couple of months later, the factory at 84 Whitechapel Road, the second one, burns down. Now, the insurance company know of the financial difficulties that Henry was in and suspected that the fire was arson, something was awry here, and they refused to pay out. At all. Now, we don't know if the fire was in fact arson or just an accident. We don't know, but the insurance company say, nah, not having it. Henry is entirely screwed. So the following year, he goes bankrupt. The remaining factory is handed to a solicitor to run on Henry's behalf to try and recoup some of the money that is owned, and it is leased out to tenants. That summer, the new tenants complain about a horrendous smell coming from the back workshop. Henry blames it on some rotting cabbages. That's what it is, rotting cabbages, that's what's causing that.
Which you need to make a brush.
Absolutely.
Some
rotting cabbages.
How is that an excuse that no one looked into?
He just said,
it's rotting cabbages, please do not follow this up at any point. Don't go and look, that's my cabbage supply. Yeah. What?
Yeah. But I mean, it does little to persuade the tenants, but rather than investigate further, they just go, fuck this, I'm off, and they leave.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's if we go digging into this, then we may be responsible for whatever we find.
They just go, nah, I don't want any of this. I'm out of here.
And cabbages, the greatest poison of them all.
Eventually, the lawyers decide that the only way to repay Henry's debts is to sell the factory.
Yeah.
And there is no other option. Now, Henry knows he has to act fast. The new owners are not going to be so easily fooled with stories of rotting cabbages. And Henry turns to his brother, Thomas, for help. Now, Thomas was an ironmonger, and he worked out of a nearby pub, the Hen and Chickens.
Yay!
Thomas had a key to the pub and a key to the cellar. It is a very large, very deep, very dark cellar that constantly smells of mould and damp. Yeah. No one would ever find a body hidden away in a quiet corner down there.
They're going to move the body?
That's the plan.
How long has she been under the ground?
About a year.
Ooh.
But how to get it from the workshop to the pub without being seen?
Some form of bucket, I believe.
So the 10th of September, Henry lets himself into the old workshop and pries up the floorboards and digs up Harriet's remains. The remains are actually remarkably well preserved. He has used some chemicals that he had intended would hasten the decomposition, but rather he's actually picked the wrong chemicals. And what he's actually sprinkled is a preservative.
Oh.
Over the corpse. So she's very well preserved. And
maybe it's arsenic. Yeah.
And there has been the smell, but otherwise it's nowhere near as decomposed as one would expect after a year.
Oh, God.
Henry dismembers the body and wraps up the remains in two large canvas parcels.
Yeah.
The next day, Henry goes to a former worker at the factory, a chap called Alfred Stokes, and asks him for help carrying some packages. Now, Alfred is only too happy to help his old boss, and Henry leads him to the workshop where the two large, neatly wrapped parcels sit on a bench. Alfred picks up the larger of the two packages and Henry the smaller, and they start out towards the Hen and Chickens. They don't get too far when Alfred starts complaining that this parcel is really heavy and it smells really bad.
Yes, what could you be transporting?
He is not sure how much further he can carry this. Henry relents and realizes he's just got a cab to begin with. He leaves both parcels with Alfred on the street and goes to find some transport. As Alfred stands waiting on the street corner, curiosity gets the better of him.
Yes.
And he pulls open the wrapping of one of the parcels, and to his horror, he sees a hand and other more unidentifiable lumps of flesh.
Ooh.
he drops the parcels, leaves them where they are, and runs to find a policeman. In the meantime, Henry returns with a cab and is really pissed off that Alfred is just fucked off,
yeah,
leaving these parcels unattended in the street. But he loads the parcels into the cab himself, and off he goes. Alfred sees the cab drive away and gives chase. He chases after it.
Good for Alfred.
Absolutely. Alfred is the hero here.
He's the hero.
At the crossing of Aldgate and Leadenhall Street, he tries to persuade two policemen that the man in the cab just there has parcels full of ladies' hands. The police think him drunk or mad.
Yes.
And send him packing.
Oh.
Henry, in the meantime, is merrily riding along in his cab, unaware of Alfred giving chase behind, where he spots Alice Day walking down the street, his ballerina mistress.
Hello.
He stops the cab and offers... Would you like a ride?
What?
Would you like a ride in my cab? And she gladly accepts and climbs in.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Henry takes long puffs on his fat cigar, trying to fill the carriage with smoke to mask the smell of Harriet's rotting remains in the parcels by his feet.
Oh my God, he's an idiot.
But my mistress is there. It'd be so lovely.
Exactly. He did not want to pass up an opportunity.
Absolutely
clearly.
Not.
What does he think is going to happen in the cab? I know it's full of cigar smoke and there's the smell of rotting flesh in here, but do you fancy a bit?
But yeah, exactly. Henry and Harriet spend a lovely carriage ride, chatting and passing the time.
A lovely carriage ride?
Well, it's delightful, while Alfred runs behind, unwilling to give up the chase.
Oh, so there's the smell and then the distant sound of a man screaming, "It's full of ladies' hands!" Alice is going, "Oh, I'm such a lucky girl.
I am such a lucky girl. What a lovely man I have." As the carriage pulls up outside the Hen and Chickens pub, Alfred was at last able to convince a constable that he was neither mad nor drunk, and that the man in the carriage had two parcels full of human bits. The constable approaches the cab and orders that the parcel be opened. Henry protests at this invasion of privacy, but nonetheless they are opened, and various parts of Harriet Lane's dismembered body tumble into the street.
Whoa.
Both Henry and Alice are arrested at once.
Yeah.
Nothing is found to incriminate Alice any further. She was an unwitting passenger in the cab, completely unaware of the package's contents, or probably even who Harriet was.
Yeah.
Henry's brother, Thomas, the one who came up with a plan for the disposal in the pub cellar, is sentenced to 7 years in prison as an accessory to murder. The evidence against Henry himself is damning, and he is sentenced to death at the Old Bailey. On the 21st of December 1875, he walks to the scaffold, calmly smoking one of his big fat cigars. Before the lever is pulled, he stares at the gathered crowd and exclaims, "Come to see a man die, have you, you curs?" And he drops to his death.
Oh, nice. Story number two.
Story number two.
Yay. Oh, that had everything too.
I know.
Good stories. Oh, these are great. We don't need to do long stories anymore. Just rattle through
lots
these.
Lots of little ones. They're fantastic.
Oh, my God. See, that one, I'm surprised there's not more detail of, like, because these are incredible stories, but as you say, we sometimes come across them and be like, oh, just if there could just be more detail in there. Yes, we could go up to London and scour through archives to get another 5 minutes of material. But incredible that he just thought that would work.
That would work, absolutely. That's the way forward.
Oh, my God. Oh, brushes.
Brushes.
They drive you mad with the power. God, Alice, that's not a good day for her.
No, indeed. Yeah, that's very unlucky.
Oh, it's all kicking off in Whitechapel.
Oh, I know. Now, do we have time for one more?
I think we do.
Okay, our last case. We're going to have three. Our last case, we are travelling out of London.
Good things come in threes.
Well, this is very true.
Out of London, you say.
Out of London. And we are going to the Midlands, to West Bromwich.
Ooh,
just
West Bromwich.
Outside Birmingham.
Oh, very good, very good.
It is 5:30 a.m. on the 25th of June, 1871. An engine driver, Isaac Blockeridge, is making his way home. What?
That is a very good engine driver name.
It's a good engine driver, yes. Isaac Blockeridge, he's an engine driver.
Yes.
So he is heading home after his shift when he sees smoke billowing from a window of one of the shacks that surround the Hall End coal pits. Isaac was familiar with the area and knew that that was the humble home of Joseph Marshall. Now, Marshall was well known in the area. He was an old colliery worker with a mean reputation, and locals had nicknamed him Lame Joe. When Isaac enters the shack, he is nearly overwhelmed by the stench of burning meat.
Meat or man?
At first, he assumes that Lame Joe has put something on to roast and forgotten about it. Passed out.
Oh.
But as he investigates further towards the fire, he sees the charred remain of a human body spread out on the hearth. Burning coals and timber had been shoveled over the body, leaving only the head and legs sticking out intact.
Oh, God.
Seeing the face, Isaac Lee instantly knows that this is the body of Lame Joe. Isaac rushes out to find the police, and they come quickly to investigate. They found that Joe had been hit in the head 3 times with enough force to crack his skull.
Oh.
The police went to Joe's usual haunts to try and find out what has been going on, and they discovered that that night he had been seen drinking at the Nag's Head, but with another collier, a chap called John Higginson, known locally as Black Jack.
These are terrible names for people.
Terrible names. Well, I'm assuming he's a collier. He's come out from the coal mine, very, very covered in coal.
So Black Jack and Lame Joe.
Black Jack and Lame Joe.
What was everyone else called?
I don't know.
Stabby Tim. Green Percy.
That's why we've got another one coming up.
Oh, good!
Apparently the two of them have been seen together quite frequently, though they're not always on the friendliest of terms. That night they had in fact been screaming at each other.
Ooh.
And had even thrown a few punches before they got kicked out the pub and they had staggered off. Black Jack's landlady said that he had gotten home at around 11 p.m. and then passed out in front of the fire. She said that he had woken at about 3 a.m. and told people he was going out mushroom picking.
Okay.
Which at the time was thought quite odd.
Yes, I'm going out for mushrooms.
I'm going out for mushrooms at 3 a.m.
Yeah, unless he was trying to get high.
Potentially. Yeah. Who knows? But Jack was gone for the best part of an hour before he returned, looking quite pale and a bit frightened. There was excitement in the air when the news broke that Lame Joe had been murdered. Jack's landlady banged on the door and urged him to come and take a look at the corpse. Come and look before the police take it away. Strangely, Jack refused and stays in his bed. Very odd behaviour, thought the landlady.
Yes.
Who wouldn't want to see that?
Yeah, get a gander at this.
Come and look at the dead on fire person.
Yeah, right. Most people would be like, I'm good, thanks, love, thank you.
Not at the time, I don't think they would be. I think it'd be odd that you didn't want to go and see. Police were quick to come and look for Jack after they found out about the fight in the pub. But they had also found 3 witnesses who saw Jack walking towards the pit jacks at around 3 a.m. that night, and then again walking the other way around 20 minutes later. This, for the police, was enough to convince them of Jack's guilt.
Yeah.
At the inquest, Black Jack had nothing to say. He seemed completely dumbfounded and confused with what was going on. Luckily, he actually had a good defence barrister on his side. He argued that Lame Joe was a worthless drunk.
Okay.
The two had simply got into a late-night quarrel, during which the simple-minded Jack had struck his opponent without the intention of killing him, entirely accidental. Somehow he managed to make them forget that the piling on of burning coals afterwards.
What?
So that was casually not mentioned again.
Yes.
The jury found Jack guilty of manslaughter. Though he was spared the death penalty, he was sentenced to life in a penal colony. Still, no one really knew why the two men had argued. They had often been seen together, but they obviously weren't friends. So why do they spend so much time together? And what on earth could Lame Joe have done to deserve such a fiery ending?
Yes.
The reason slowly came out of the woodwork. No one mourned the passing of Lame Joe. He was a mean-spirited, ugly, cross-eyed, selfish, angry man.
You're painting quite the picture of this man.
Some said even a warlock.
Oh, a warlock. Okay, this story just took a turn.
Black Jack, well, he was a simple, superstitious countryman. He knew well enough to steer clear of cross-eyed people. They possessed magic powers.
Do they?
They do.
Do they?
They
I've
do.
Not heard that.
Well, apparently Black Jack thought so.
He's cross-eyed.
He
must be magical.
He has magic powers.
Best visual impairment that he has. All his other senses are heightened.
Joe knew of Jack's superstitious ways and takes full advantage. Joe claimed that he would put the evil eye on Jack unless he kept his ale jug full and his belly fed.
Oh, he's blackmailing him.
Blackmailing him. Blackmailing Black Jack. Buy him beer, buy him food, and I will not put the evil eye on you.
Nice.
Jack tries to evade Joe by changing his drinking spots, but Joe always tracks him down to share his drinking money, to share in Jack's drinking money.
Ooh.
After months and months of these threats and blackmail, Jack has had enough. The only way to preserve what was left of his beer money was to get a little magic on his side. Of his own.
No.
And so he goes to consult with another local warlock, known as the Sedgley Wizard.
No! The Sedgley Wizard,
which I googled, and there is no other mention of him apart from this story, I'm really annoyed about, because I want him to be a thing.
I'm sure he is, but then he's a warlock. He has wiped his name from the annals of history.
Absolutely. So Black Jack has gone to see the Sedgley Wizard. The wizard told Jack that the only way to rid himself of Lame Joe and his curse is to kill him and reduce his body to cinder. And then he will be free.
Oh my God.
Jack followed the wizard advice.
It doesn't sound like much wizardly advice. It sounds like someone going, just kill him. I don't... Yeah.
And I'm sure he charged a pretty penny for
exactly.
that piece of advice.
He's a shit warlock. You'd expect him to at least go put 3 drops of this tincture into his beer and he shall be incapacitated. Sounds like he's just found someone in the street and going, I've heard you, who was wearing a funny hat that day, and they were, just kill him, mate. Just burn his body,
whack him on the head, set him on fire, no more curses. But Black Jack say he was a simple-minded, superstitious chap. He believed what he had been told. That was the end of Lame Joe and his cross-eyed evil ways.
Love it! Love it! Back then, this is what, 1871?
Absolutely, 1870s.
So superstition back then is absolutely. That you have to burn the body. And the body, and then if it's a changeling, they'll jump out. But also, yes, they reduce it to cinders, otherwise the curse will follow you everywhere.
Quite.
I mean, power to Lame Joe, if he was a warlock or not. He's just like, this guy is terrified of stuff. I'm gonna milk this
for what I can.
I can just imagine him kind of jumping out behind trees and turning up, popping up behind the bar. I'm a warlock. I'm going to curse your family.
Buy me a beer.
And that was it. He just wanted beer and sandwiches. Blackjack, what an idiot. Yeah. Falling for it every time. Probably the locals loved this.
Well, absolutely. The innkeepers are raking it in.
If Lame Joe was known as mean, then people probably thought, you are really being cruel to this poor, simple-minded man.
Absolutely. Or they all believed it. Because it's a superstitious time.
Yeah.
Many people may well have accepted that, no, this was...
I'll put the evil eye on you.
This was a thing. And if this suspicion of cross-eyed people and things was... It may have been very local to that area. Mm. But if everyone knew of that superstition, then yeah, absolutely.
Well,
he is a man to be feared.
If you're the sort of person who looks different, what are the other physical tropes of witchcraft and warlocking?
Well, there's a 3-nipple thing.
If you do go into the pub and just go, hey, everybody have a look, buy me
it's
pints.
It's a surefire way to get extra pints.
So 3 nipples. Isn't that just from Scaramanga?
No, I think there's a devil thing, because your familiars suckle on the 3rd nipple and things.
Okay, well, straight to the nipples.
I'm sure warts and things. If you had a wart, then absolutely.
There's the old thing of a man with his eyebrows meeting in the middle. He's a werewolf.
He's a vampire.
Or a vampire.
Yeah.
He's a werewolf.
Werewolf.
Yeah, werewolf. Or he's evil.
Widow's Peak was the vampire.
Yes. Eyebrows meet in the middle, or he's the devil in disguise or something. But I think there's other physical traits. Well,
big third eye in the middle. That'll do it.
Big pointy hat. And
12 arms.
Yes, with a brush.
Yeah, brush.
A brush supplied from Whitechapel with a cat on it. That's a sure fuck. Sorry.
Those curly shoes.
No, that's genies.
Ah, got it wrong. Big harem pants.
Yes, which would make you stand out in the Midlands at the time. Oh God, please make it that Lame Joe had like cross eyes and like an eyebrow that met the middle and just big harem pants. That's a good story. Is it the Sedgwick Wizard?
The Sedgley Wizard.
Sedgley Wizard. Was just a guy on the street.
Absolutely.
Who are you? Sedgley Wizard.
I'm the Sedgley Wizard. Ooh.
Because obviously the news had spread that poor Black Jack was like, he believes everyone's a wizard. We can coin this in. But 3 stories.
3 stories.
Excellent stories as well. Ooh, I love those.
Funny stories, silly stories. Crazy Victorian nonsense.
Crazy. And bloody murder.
And bloody murder.
Yeah, pretty grim, all of this. What do you think, people? We hope you enjoy the little mini story format. I personally love it.
Oh, I've got a whole book full of these. There'll be loads more.
Oh, yeah. Well, we do come across loads of little mini stories that just you can't stretch out. They're so good, but you know, it would really be doing you a disservice if you kind of went 15 minutes, that's it. But if you've got more in that case, little tiny nuggets, do send them through. But yes, tell us what you think of the stories. You had 3 there. as ever, jump on the comments of this episode, share your thoughts with us about the stories, new stories you want to hear. What do you think of all the characters that we've come across today? By all means, do voice notes if you want through Instagram of what you think the first guy's accent sounded like.
Oh yes, that'll be a good
the
one.
The Scottish French one. Do some videos on Instagram or wherever you
nice.
Do your social media and just tag us in it. Just do impressions of that. And the guy in the middle brushes. Why are your brush factories so funny? He was confident to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you on Friday for the main episode. We will see you next week for more Deadly Nightcaps. But in the meantime, keep drinking, keep talking about poison, and remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.